Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, September 19th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. I am really excited about this week's episode, but before we dive into it, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Now, you know that the show is 100% free to download and always, always will be. And you know, the reason it's possible is because many of you choose to pledge your support through different outlets. Specifically, probably the best one is through Patreon. If you're interested in supporting the show, you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy and learn all about it. And don't forget to visit the website, carasantamaria.com, where you will see a lot of other ways you can support the show, like rating and reviewing on iTunes, and also visiting the Talk Nerdy store, where we've got lots of cool stuff for sale right now, especially some brand new leather pieces by Foster Leathercraft, like beautiful hand-tooled bookmarks. Okay. I'm really excited about this week's episode. I actually made a good segue there and I didn't even use it. You can use one of those bookmarks in Maya's new book. Oh my God. So my guest this week is Maya Solovitz. She is an author. She specializes in science writing and has a strong focus on addiction and evidence-based practices for addiction treatment. She has a brand new book out. It's a fabulous book called Unbroken Brain: A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. I recommend everybody check it out. You can find more on the website where I have links to everything. All right, guys, without any further ado, here she is, Maya Solovitz. So Maya, thank you so much for joining me today. I think the last time we met must have been many years ago in the flesh.
Yes, absolutely. I think it was Science Online.
How much do you miss those conferences?
No, those were definitely fun. It's a shame that it all had to end, but oh well.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it was so cool to have kind of a meeting of the minds of individuals that work in a lot of aspects of science outreach.
Yes.
And you represent, I think, in many ways, an ideal job, a dream job for a lot of people that work in comms, science, journo, because you do investigative work.
Yes, I mean, it varies. I do a wide variety of different things. I write books, I do investigative stuff, I do opinion stuff, I do, you know, just sort of features. And so it's really quite varied.
Which I would assume makes it so much more fun.
Yes, I mean, I think when I get bored with something, I can just do something else, which is useful.
Yeah, that's great. And so you've had a long history writing for Time Magazine, but you've also written for a ton of outlets. Like, I see your byline everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that at the moment is to do with the fact that my book is just out. But other than that, I have written for many, many different places. And every time I sort of hope that I have a set of regular places that I'm writing for, a few of them fold. No. Not that it's me. I don't think I caused that. But
No. I have a similar track record when I work on TV shows. I think it's just the nature of journalism right now. It's a bummer.
Yeah. No, I mean, but I do think that it seemed in the last few years that things are starting to stabilize.
Yeah. Yeah, I think maybe people are finding their grooves and they're understanding that it is a new landscape.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So I'm looking at my bookshelf. The last book of yours that I read came out a few years ago now, and it was called Born for Love: Why Empathy is Essential and Endangered. But you have a new book now, Unbroken Brain, which just came out this year. Tell me a little about it.
So it's basically looking at addiction from a new direction. And the scientists who read this book will be like, oh, this is totally old news. The problem is that old news was never communicated to the public. And what the book is about is that addiction is a learning and developmental disorder. And if you look at it that way, a lot of the really puzzling features of it can be explained. And you can also get past the very tedious, it's a disease, it's a sin debate. Mm-hmm. So I just thought if we understand how critical learning is to addiction, a lot of different pieces fall into place. For example, the National Institute on Drug Abuse and the DSM define addiction as compulsive behavior that continues despite negative consequences. Fundamentally, that means that addiction involves failing to learn from punishment around drugs. This should give us a very good clue about what to do about drug policy, which is exactly what we're not doing. Yeah. So that's one part of what I wanted to discuss in the book. And the other part is that the learning that goes awry in addiction is learning in the areas that are involved in love and attachment, basically. So you fall in love with a drug rather than a person. And this creates much more intense and behaviorally important memories than if you are just studying some random subject that you don't care about. So when you love something, you will persist despite negative consequences in order to maintain that relationship. And that's evolutionarily necessary for mammals. If we couldn't do that, who would ever be able to survive having kids?
True, which is why from the outside, it almost seems irrational. But there is an intrinsic motivation there.
Well, exactly. And that's why addiction seems so irrational from the outside as well, because you can't understand that the person who's addicted sees that the drug is basically essential to their emotional survival.
Gotcha. And this really kind of harkens to things that happen in early development, right?
Yes, absolutely. And so temperament is really important in addiction. A lot of people have the mistaken idea that there's this single addictive personality and that every person with addiction has this personality, and it's a horrible bad personality that involves lying and being manipulative and basically being an overall bad person. Mm-hmm. In fact, that is not the case. There are extremes of temperament, some of which are opposite to each other, that predispose people to addiction. For example, if you're very anxious and socially awkward, you might be drawn to substances that make you feel calm and connected. On the other hand, if you are bold and looking for stimulation and you want to do things like mountain climbing, well, drugs also might seem quite interesting to you.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, it does seem like there are individuals for whom a temperament allows them experimentation and then an ability to walk away. And there are individuals for whom, probably because of all of these different parameters, developmental issues, genetics, and also just circumstance,
yes,
that experiment kind of turns into something that lasts a lot longer than they'd like.
Right. Well, about 10 to 20% of people who experiment with substances like alcohol, heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine will become addicted. The rest of them will not. Mm-hmm. Most of the people who do become addicted actually stop or age out of their addiction without any treatment. Mm-hmm. The people that you see going to treatment over and over are the absolute worst cases. And so we've developed this view of addiction as being this incurable thing that is always chronic because we don't look at most of the addicted population. But if you look at the epidemiology, what you'll see is that by age 30, most people who meet qualifications for a DSM diagnosis of what used to be called dependence and now is more appropriately called substance use disorder, the people who meet that criteria by age 30, half of them no longer meet that criteria. And most of them did not go to treatment, and many of them are using occasionally, but they do not have problems.
And for some reason, when we develop these treatment protocols, we are just not considering that statistical data?
Well, not okay. The world of addiction is completely divorced from science.
Yeah.
And this is a very distressing thing for those of us who have to deal with it, because we have 80% of addiction treatment is based on principles from the 1930s that involve meeting, confession, and prayer. That's literally 80% of addiction treatment is based on 12-step programs, and the entire point of the treatment program is to indoctrinate the patient into the idea that they must go to meetings, surrender to a higher power, confess their sins, make restitution, deal with their character defects. This is a very moralistic way of seeing addiction.
Yeah.
But because 12-step programs also claim, but wait, we see addiction as a disease, this confounds everything. Because there's no other disease that we treat this way. There's no other disease where simply having the symptoms gets you locked up. There's no other disease where we think that locking you up will cure it. You know, and there's no other disease where if you go to the best of the best doctors, you will be told that meeting, confession, and prayer is your best bet.
Oh, God, it's worse in essence than a lot of the stigma and a lot of the kind of draconian approaches that we have historically had to mental illness.
Yes, and it unfortunately ends up being this weird self-replicating thing where people who are sort of scientifically inclined avoid the addictions field unless they're going into like neuroscience, and then they avoid the clinical side of it. But in the treatment field, getting evidence into practice has been way more difficult than getting evidence into practice in medicine, which is not easy in the first place. At least in medicine, there's generally not active resistance to changing. The resistance to change is generally passive. Like, it's like, I learned to do it this way, so I'm doing it this way.
Yeah.
But in the addiction field, it's generally been like, I learned to do it this way, and this is the one true way. And if you're not getting it, it's your problem. It's nothing to do with my method. And so it becomes very, also, not to mention the fact that there's a extremely undereducated and overworked and underpaid workforce, many of whom don't have high school degrees.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no other area of medicine where if you have the disease and you recover from it, you're automatically a doctor.
That would be true. I would be really afraid if that were the structure of how you become a medical practitioner in this country.
Well, yes, and this is what we put people with addiction through, even though addiction is a really complex condition that is often comorbid with multiple other problems. So 50% of people with addiction have a pre-existing mental illness, and this number is higher for people, for women. They're, you know, two-thirds of people with addiction have severe child trauma issues. And many of the people who have mental illness also have trauma. So you get this very heterogeneous, very complex condition that we think that there's one solution to, and then we wonder why what we're doing doesn't work, especially since what we're doing is the opposite of the definition of the problem, because we've defined the problem as resistance to punishment, and we're basically using punishment to try to fix it.
So not only do we have quote-unquote treatment measures that completely ignore the science, that don't take into account any of the comorbidity, any of the, you know, accompanying disorders like childhood trauma, homelessness, low SES, all these other things that could contribute comorbid mental illness, we're also doing something that will likely exacerbate the addiction.
Basically the case, because a lot of the treatment, aside from being moralistic, is infantilizing and mm-hmm. re-traumatizes the traumatized people. Because the idea is that we will force you to hit bottom by breaking you down, and we will just make the consequences so horrible you'll never want to do this again. But of course, that doesn't work. The problem in addiction is generally not that people are having so much of a good, fun time that they just don't want to stop. The problem is that they don't believe there's anything else in their life that will give them meaning and hope and comfort. And unless you can provide alternative sources of those things, it's generally not going to work.
It reminds me of the way that some historically have approached women's rights or reproductive issues, where there's this idea, it's so divorced from empathy, that somehow, for example, getting an abortion is like a first line of birth control for many women.
Right, and like, who thinks like that?
Yeah, like, nobody is like, I can't wait to get an abortion, just like nobody's like, I can't wait to enjoy that next horrible, you know, bender.
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly it is the case that there can be pleasure in using addictive and psychoactive substances, but by the time you are addicted, that has generally drained out of it. And when you relapse, you will tend to experience not so great things.
And that really has to do with potentiation too, right? That's a true like neuroscience phenomenon. Your brain has gotten so used to having a large amount of substance.
It's partially that, but it's a little bit more complicated because you get tolerance to some effects. Like, you basically get tolerance to the pleasurable effects, but you get sensitization, which is the opposite of tolerance to, for example, if you're taking cocaine, you will find that when you take it, if you become addicted, the amount of paranoia and craving and wanting and desire for more will escalate far more than the satisfaction you get when you actually take it.
Yeah.
So you can sit there, and I had this experience personally where you know that if you shoot cocaine, it is going to suck. It is going to feel horrible. You're going to feel anxious and uncomfortable, and you're going to be desperate to do it again. And yet you're going to do it anyway.
Yeah. Even though you can rationally say, obviously, this is not necessarily in my best interest. If I was going to make a pro and con list, you know, it's easy to say I shouldn't do this, but I have to do this. I need it.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just like, it's more like you just want it so much that everything else like fades away in the light of that desire. And, you know, people talk about dopamine in this context. And what's important to realize is that dopamine isn't pleasure. Dopamine is about reward prediction and about desire. And desire is only pleasurable if there will ultimately be satisfaction. Infinite desire is really awful. And
yeah,
what addiction promotes is like infinite desire with no satiation. And, you know, it's slightly different with opioids because opioids are basically the brain's chemical of satiation.
Yeah, so it does feel good while you're effed up.
With opioids, more so than with stimulants.
Yeah.
And I can just put it this way, like, I reserve the right to take opioids in my 90s or something like this, but I really have no desire to ever take cocaine again. And that's because, you can't really get sick of satiation, but you absolutely can get over the feeling of, I want more desire.
Yeah. Yeah. That's that's probably the most difficult thing to get past. It's interesting. I'm trying to empathize. And we always, when we do that, we think of our own experience, right? And I've done my fair share of drugs, don't get me wrong, but I've never been somebody who, as we said, I'm like that 90% who like did ecstasy and did acid and did coke and was like, I don't, you know, I got what I got out of it. It was fun for a while and I'm over it. The one
Psychedelics are not particularly addictive.
They're really not. Yeah, that's true. So I'm always amazed when I have friends who are like, quote unquote, acid heads. I'm like, how did you do so much acid over your lifespan? But I would say that the one substance that I struggled with when I was younger, up until maybe 5 years ago, was cigarettes.
Yeah, well, and I mean, cigarettes are the exception to the most, at least half of people have their addictions ended by age 30. Mm-hmm. And the thing with cigarettes that's unique is, one, the really extreme negative consequences don't happen for 30 to 40 years.
Yeah, it's a real delay in the
outcomes. So there's that. But the other point, the other and probably more important bit of it is that you don't get intoxicated. Like the mm-hmm. high doesn't cause impairment. And so that also means that, you know, the consequences are delayed. And, you know, with addiction, the defining experience of it is, you know, persisting despite everything going wrong. Yeah. If everything isn't going wrong and you're persisting in a compulsive behavior, that behavior really isn't a problem.
It's true. Like, you know cognitively that down the line it could be problematic. And there's some small things. Oh, my yes. cardio's not there. I get winded when I climb the stairs. I might have a little bit of a cough. I have to use cough drops more often than other people. But for the most part, when you're in your 20s and you're a smoker, even a pack-a-day smoker, you kind of feel yeah. fine.
No, and I mean, what I find fascinating is that, you know, in the 50s and 60s, we had 50% of the population smoking. Mm-hmm. And virtually all of those were smoking a pack a day. So they yeah. were addicted. What we have now is that most people who smoke, smoke only when they drink, mm-hmm. unless they're mentally ill. The yeah. mentally ill and the extremely poor tend to be addicted smokers. But the college kids who smoke today tend to be, oh, I smoke when I drink.
Fascinating.
And, you know, that it's basically because we've changed the environment so much, we've reduced the addictiveness of cigarettes because we've reduced the cues that you get to smoke because you can't do it in so many places now.
That's true. Yeah, I was in the South, so there was a holdover there. You know, I think that a lot of the legislation lagged in the
yes,
South.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
So I was still able to smoke in diners when I was in high school, and then by college,
oh, wow.
I couldn't smoke inside, but I might be able to smoke just outside of someplace. And my campus had ashtrays, and I don't drink. So I was
oh,
that
right.
small percentage of people who just, I was addicted. Like, smoking was
yeah.
my reward mechanism. I'm writing a paper. Once I finish three more paragraphs, I've earned a cigarette. You know, it's those
right,
little
right.
things that helps you pace the day. And
yeah.
it's very hard to quit. For me, it was a function of, just like you were saying, you want it so bad, it becomes a need. The only way I knew I was finally ready to quit is because I wanted to not be a smoker more than I wanted a cigarette.
Right. And that's really basically the fundamental way to get, yeah, unless you get there, it's going to be very difficult to stop.
Yeah, it's very hard to quit something if you don't really want to quit, because
well,
you're
no,
not doing
I mean,
it for an external reason.
Yeah, and it's just unlikely that you are mm-hmm. going to do so. I mean, and this is, again, why so many of our approaches to addiction are just so backwards, because we have this idea that we can change what other people want, and that's really hard to do. Mm-hmm. You know, try to make somebody fall in love with you who isn't in love with you. You're basically not going to succeed.
Yeah, you're basically going to go to prison, probably. Well,
yes, for stalking, yes. you know, or if you just simply, you know, you want somebody to like something that you like and they don't like it. There's nothing, you know, I mean, our wants and our desires are very, you know, the reason that it's so hard is that wants and desires are kind of programmed. You know, they're emotions, and our emotions are, you know, sort of decision-making algorithms. So if we're trying to make decisions about our emotions, it's going to be very difficult.
Yeah. Do you find in your research and in your reporting that psychotherapy, one-on-one talk therapy on a regular basis has positive outcomes for individuals with addiction?
It's completely variable. I mean, the data on psychotherapy for addiction is not good, particularly on like psychodynamic psychotherapy.
So we don't even have good science to go from.
No, I mean, the, I think the, basically, it is possible that one-on-one therapy could work. And it's certainly the case that if you use cognitive behavioral and motivational enhancement approaches, which have been proven to work, and you have a good rapport with a person, there's absolutely no reason why it shouldn't work. Except with the exception of opioids, which for opioids, the only treatment that we know of that cuts the death rate at least in half is ongoing maintenance with either buprenorphine or methadone. And, you know, we deny that fact to our peril. We are letting people die because we think that people who are taking these medications are not really in recovery and they're always high and this is a bunch of nonsense.
Why do people have that idea?
Well, the thing is, people don't really understand tolerance. So they think that, oh, like they're taking an opioid. It's a drug in the same class. So they're just substituting one drug for another. They think that physically needing a drug to function is the same thing as addiction. But addiction is compulsive behavior despite negative consequences. And so once you recognize what addiction is, you can see that what happens during successful maintenance is that a person moves from the compulsion around the illegal, chaotic lifestyle to simply having the same dose at the same time every day. So they're completely tolerant, no longer intoxicated, able to drive, able to get on with their life. They replace the addiction with simple physical dependence. And, you know, all of us are physically dependent on something, whether it's air, water, or food.
That's like saying that I'm addicted to my SSRI or my mother's addicted to her insulin.
Exactly. And see, this historically, we've gotten this really wrong. Like, we used to think that physical dependence was like the key to addiction, and therefore cocaine wasn't addictive, marijuana wasn't addictive, the only true addictions were like heroin and alcohol. And so that obviously caused a lot of problems, for example, crack. The idea that, you know, physically getting sick is the problem in addiction is just wrong, because if the withdrawal period were what was the problem with opioids, then you could lock somebody up for a few weeks and they'd be cured.
And that's what they do. That's what a detox tank
is. Right. And so, you know, you've just basically taken the drug out of the system, but what you haven't done is addressed why the person feels such a sense of despair that they want to escape. And if you don't do that, the physical dependence is just not the critical piece. Now, this is not to say that it's fun to go through withdrawal or that, we shouldn't absolutely do what we need to do in order to reduce physical withdrawal symptoms.
Of course.
But it is to say that the psychological is far more important, and pretending that the psychological is fake and insubstantial and the physical is real has done tremendous damage to everybody in the addictions world.
Yeah, I mean, I know everybody listening to this podcast either has dealt with it personally, has a family member, or has an extended person, like a friend or a friend of a friend, who's dealt with severe addiction. And how many of them have not detoxed multiple times? Like,
I know
many people who have been through so many treatment programs, and they'll even be clean for 10 years. And then something bad happens, and it all starts again.
Well, and this is why it's just so dangerous to see it as, you know, once it has become a chronic condition, you really need to take care of yourself around it. It's not a matter of, oh, I just get it out of my system for a couple of weeks and then I'm fixed. Like, that just isn't, you know, what happens. What happens is that you need to figure out what psychological need is the addiction fulfilling and find better ways of getting that. Yeah. And unless you do that, you're going to be at risk of relapse.
And even with cigarettes, which was my experience, which also doesn't quite fit the mold for the reasons you mentioned before, the only way that I am cigarette free, you know, 5, 6 years later, is because I don't let myself even just have one.
Right.
I can't have a single cigarette.
Right. And I mean, that's a good thing to know about yourself.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in the addictions field, this has gotten translated into the idea that if you have one, you're powerless, and then you're going to automatically have 30.
Yeah.
And that means that if you do slip and have one, it makes it much more likely that you will have 30.
That's true, because that's that falling off the wagon phenomenon we talk about where
exactly. It
seems like a better strategy would be, okay, you messed up. Let's get you back on track. Let's just
because otherwise you do get this all or nothing thing. Now, that doesn't mean that you should decide, oh, I can have one. What it means is that if something bad happens and you do have one, you don't need to believe, oh, I've blown it. It's too late. I may as well have 30. And you don't need to believe that you are completely out of control of your behavior, because what the other point that I was trying to make in Unbroken Brain is that since addiction is basically like falling in love, getting over an addiction is more like getting over a breakup. And if you see that guy again, it doesn't mean you're doomed. It may give you a little bit of a setback, but it is not a sign that you're going to fall back into the whole thing again, necessarily. So it's really the hopeful message there is that your brain isn't broken. Your brain has just learned the wrong thing. And when you learn the wrong thing in the deep way that occurs during addiction, it makes change very difficult. But it doesn't mean that you're brain damaged. And it doesn't mean that you can't do the things you want to do. In fact, if you have that persistence despite negative consequences and you use it for more productive goals, it can be very helpful.
Yeah. I mean, and the truth is, everyone persists in some areas despite negative consequences. It's just some people are, quote, unlucky enough that those negative consequences are overt and are, like, medically damaging and psychologically damaging.
Yeah. I mean, also, you know, I could never succeed as a writer just if I didn't persist despite negative consequences, because I get rejected all the time.
It can be a character building experience and one that helps you succeed in your chosen profession.
No, exactly. And I think, you know, it's important for people with addiction to know that, because we are so stigmatized, and the idea that we are diseased and broken and unable to change and once an addict, always an addict, and you know, we're just useless, junky, worthless people. Mm. You know, that's not the case. There's many, many wonderful, fabulous, good people with addictions. And when you can turn that energy in a more productive manner, you can do amazing things.
Just look at the number of people, like you mentioned before, it's a bad system and it's a weird strategy, but look at the number of people that are addiction counselors now, that are working within the addiction population to help because they have those histories.
Yeah, and I mean, I want to say that I am not saying that anybody who has a personal experience of addiction is automatically a bad addiction counselor.
No, of course not, but that shouldn't be like the only prerequisite. Like, you should probably go to school too.
Yeah. I feel like we need to teach people, like, people with addiction can bring enormous empathy and passion and all kinds of good stuff to their work. We just need to make sure they're trained appropriately, they're paid appropriately, and that they understand that there are many routes to recovery.
You know, I think you're a prime example of that. You are an incredibly successful science writer, multi-award winning author, and you've mentioned multiple times throughout the interview, you know, the addiction community, or when I was struggling with, I think you mentioned specifically cocaine. I would love to hear how your experience informed your work. Did they happen concurrently? Did one kind of beget the other?
Well, I mean, I was, you know, I mean, it's hard to like place the beginning of this, but when I was in high school, I was obsessed with being a TV journalist. And then I got obsessed with drugs. Mm-hmm. And then in college, I was sort of, aside from my drug obsession, like, oh, should I go into neuroscience or should I be a journalist? And when I finally got into recovery, I sort of split the middle by being a science journalist. And so addiction actually gives you an incredible education in covering science, because the science of addiction is often so bad that it allows you to like very vividly get lessons in things like correlation is not cause, and here's sampling bias, and you know, all of these things I can point to very easily in, unfortunately, a lot of popular coverage of addiction.
Yeah. And so you go into this world, and obviously you are tasked sometimes with writing outside of that niche, but do you just feel yourself drawn into the addiction literature?
What happens is I kind of go in and out. Like, I have had periods in my career where I've been entirely focused on addiction, and then where I do broader neuroscience. Mm-hmm. It's kind of good to get out of the little niche sometimes. I can also get bored or frustrated with the addiction stuff. And when I do, you know, sort of broader mental health or neuroscience, it's, you know, kind of refreshing. Mm-hmm. Also, I think one of the things that has made my work useful is that I look at addiction from a multidisciplinary perspective. So I don't just look at the neuroscience. I look at the psychology and the sociology and the politics and all of these different disciplines that often don't talk to each other.
Yeah.
So to have like this kind of grounding in all of those things because of my knowledge of the addictions research in that area, it also helps me to be able to cover, you know, other things that might be going on in psychology or et cetera. So it gives you a way of thinking about things across disciplines, which I think is very helpful.
You know, you mentioned that one of those disciplines that you focus on is sort of the political, you know, environment around addiction.
Yes.
How are policy decisions, legislation decisions informed by addiction research, or the lack of informing them by addiction research? And what are some of these outcomes? Probably one of the best known works of yours, or maybe the one that was very influential within the addiction arena early on in your career, was Help at Any Cost.
Yes.
A book that you wrote in 2006, correct?
Yes, yes. And that was the first history of tough love in the treatment of so-called troubled teens, or people, most of whom are being treated or allegedly treated for drug problems. And we have this lengthy history in the addictions and mental health field of this non-scientific nonsense catching on and becoming huge. And basically, that book looked at how the troubled teen programs like wilderness programs and teen boot camps and emotional growth boarding schools and all these kinds of things were based on a cult that originally said that it had a cure for heroin addiction. And this spread throughout the addictions field, like the 18-month residential treatments for addiction in the United States up until very recently were all based on the cult directly, or based on other people who based their work on this cult. And I know that sounds incredibly strange, but the cult was called Synanon. It is famous for having put a snake in the mailbox of an attorney who was trying to sue them, and it was a rattlesnake with the rattles cut off, and he got bit. And this meant that the founder of the cult ended up in jail for conspiracy to commit murder.
Wow.
But while all of that was going on, states were sending representatives to understand how this cult had supposedly cured heroin addiction. The secret to their cure to heroin addiction is one that is still widely used in addiction treatment, which is basically make addiction treatment so abusive and intense that everybody who isn't motivated drops out, and suddenly you've got a 90% success rate as long as you don't count the dropouts.
Jesus. And so this quote-unquote tough love approach, which if you kind of cook the book, seems like, oh no, look, it has good outcomes, is really just about forcing
about
the kids out of
bias.
The program. Yeah.
Yeah, it's totally, I mean, this is why I say that, you know, if you want a good education in crappy science, you should study addiction, because they're, you know, it's like all of this, all of the pitfalls of outcomes research can be shown in the history of addiction treatment. And what was astonishing to me, actually, and here's one of the rare moments where I get to praise New Jersey, is that during the 70s, when Synanon, which was this cult, was really catching on and inspiring programs like Phoenix House in New York and Daytop in New York and Delancey Street in San Francisco, New Jersey, rather than replicating it immediately, decided to do a study first. Mm-hmm. And they were the ones that found out that, oh yeah, only 15% of the people are actually recovering. And that group is basically the amount of people that would recover without amount of time anyway.
Wow. So all things being equal, absolutely no positive outcomes. If anything, potentially and documented, horribly negative outcomes.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you take a group, a population that is incredibly traumatized, and you scream at them and humiliate them and sleep deprive them and tell them that they're pieces of crap and make them dress up like hookers and make them dress in drag and do all this other insane, absurd stuff to them. Yeah, you're going to re-traumatize them. And gee, trauma actually increases the risk of relapse in addiction and increases the risk that people who have minor drug problems will end up with major drug problems. So yeah, putting teenagers into these environments is completely counterproductive and absolutely does harm.
And sometimes,
you know,
fatalistically, like we're
yeah,
not just
it has
talking
killed
about
people.
Yeah, it's killed people. Oh.
And I mean, yeah, so like the thing with that book, you know, the aim of that book was to basically show parents that this stuff has no scientific basis. It does harm. If you feel pressured by people to put your child into one of these institutions, you should ignore that pressure. It doesn't mean you're being a bad parent if you don't practice tough love. In fact, it means you're being a good protective parent. Mm. And, you know, this industry needs to be held to account.
I love it. You know, when it comes to your new book, Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction, who is your target audience? Who are you really writing for?
I'm writing for people with addiction, families of people with addiction, people in the addictions field, policymakers, anyone who really wants to understand what it's like to go through this and why we're getting it wrong.
It's funny because even within the title, like you mentioned, a revolutionary new way of understanding addiction, this is something that somehow within the literature and within these siloed areas of science has been known for quite a long time, but it just hasn't broken through to sort of culture and society.
Yeah.
And I think it's
so great.
And
I mean, that's what I'm trying to do is like translate the science in a way that, you know, I mean, what was fascinating when I first started writing about addiction as a learning disorder, a couple of articles I was writing while I was writing the book, I got this real pushback from scientists saying, oh, we know this, that's not new. And I'm like, it may not be new to you, but you really haven't communicated this to the public. And you know, whenever I speak about it, people are like, wow, I've never heard this. And, you know, that's because most people don't spend their time sitting around reading the Journal of Neuroscience. And even if they did, they probably wouldn't understand most of it. And if they, you know, try to like sort of cut through what's being said, I mean, you know, the neuroscience people in addiction have just adopted the disease language.
Yeah.
And I understand why they do that. You know, the word disease is basically your ticket to getting medical coverage for something. But the problem is that when you say disease in the context of American addiction treatment, what you're saying is you need to go to a 12-step group. And what you're saying is, therefore, this is actually not a disease. And so this is why I'd like to sort of shift the dialogue away to seeing it as a learning disorder, which it absolutely is. And if you want to say a learning disorder is a disease, I'm not going to sue you. But, you know, I think that it's better to look at the learned aspects of it because those are fundamental to its character. And the learned aspects show why punishment doesn't work and also why so many people actually do get better and how we can teach more people to get better.
I think it's such an important message to be shared. I think that there's some truly important and noble journalism that you're doing there. And also, it really is in many ways a public service. And so I have to thank you for doing the work that you do. I have to thank you for joining me on the podcast to talk about it. But before I let you off the hook,
sure.
I know we're keeping it a little short because we had some technical issues at the beginning of the recording. I close my podcast the same way each week. I ask my guests the same two questions, and I am really excited to hear your answers.
Okay.
So, when you personally think about the future, whether it's the future of your life, the future of the planet, the future of humanity, whatever it is that grips you, I would love to know first, what is the thing that keeps you up most at night? What is the thing that, you know, worries you the most or discourages you the most? And then on the flip side of that, my second question would be, what are you the most optimistic and hopeful about?
Well, I mean, this kind of goes back to that book about empathy. And, you know, one of the things that, I mean, we just had the 15th anniversary of 9/11, and one of the things that sort of led me to despair around that time was just, you know, I was covering all this amazing science that was finding ways to understand all of these deep problems that we have, mental illnesses, addictions, you know, relationship problems, all kinds of things that have really caused a lot of harm. And, you know, we see this amazing science and we're beginning to understand a lot about how evolution shaped us to be relationally connected people and how social support does amazing things. And then here's this completely irrational jerks like taking down our buildings and killing lots of people. And just the contrast between the conversations I have with scientists who get that inequality is a horrible, bad thing, and it makes it bad even for the rich. And the policymakers who are just sort of enslaved to the billionaires, you know, that's where I despair. That's where I think, oh, we're not going to solve, you know, global climate change, and we're not going to, you know, we're going to do something stupid like elect Trump.
It's that, this, like, ass-backward political, I don't know, gridlock or just manipulation. I don't know how to describe it, but it is pretty disappointing.
Yeah, and it's like, it's sort of self-reinforcing. It's like a vicious cycle because the more inequality you get, the more anxious and scrambling people get, both at the bottom and at the top. They just want to hold on to what they have, and then they become irrational and racist and, you know, all kinds of other things. And, you know, when you have a virtuous circle, you have people trusting each other, connecting with each other. When you have trust and empathy and support, you can have abstract thought and creativity and all kinds of fascinating new ideas. And so humanity has both of these sides. And my hope for the future is that we will work to make society so that children are brought up in environments that are as relationally healthy as possible so that we can have access to the talents of all people, whether they have disabilities, whether they have mental illness, whether they are members of minority groups, whether they're women. You know, we have an enormous amount of human talent that we're just completely wasting by doing things like sending people to jail for having addiction. And we are traumatizing their children simultaneously and ensuring that this will continue for other generations. We do have a way. We understand a lot about what to do about a lot of this stuff, and we understand a lot to do about how to prevent addictions and how to mitigate mental illnesses and how to mitigate disabilities. And, you know, if we can just put the knowledge that we have into practice, we could have a pretty amazing world.
Hear, hear, sister. Well, guys, Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction is out now. Wherever you can buy books, you can pick up a copy of that. And Maya, let everyone know kind of where you exist in the social media space if they want to
Tweet
you, bug you, all that good stuff.
So, yeah, so I'm at Maya SZ, which is just M-A-I-A, S like Sam, Z like zebra. On Twitter, I am on there way too much. you can also find my book and other information at mayasz.com. And those are basically the best ways to find me.
Awesome. So enjoy the rest of your day. Are you in New York?
I am indeed in New York, yes.
I could guess by the sirens in the background.
Oh, gosh, yes. And that was mild. This is a very mild time. Like, we didn't get construction noise or, like, honking.
I could yeah, pick it out on a map based by the ambiance. I love that. Well, enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you so much for joining me. And everybody listening, thank you for tuning in week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk 30.